So we are looking at the life of Jacob this spring. As you'll recall, Jacob is the son of Isaac and the grandson of Abraham, and he is the person that God has chosen to work through in order to build first a family, and then several clans, and then ultimately a nation, and finally a people through whom God may bring salvation to all peoples of the earth. Now, throughout his life, as Jacob confronts his own identity, and his brokenness and his need for grace, Jacob wrestles with God. And at one point, as we'll see, quite literally. But when we last saw Jacob, he was literally and symbolically on a solo journey through some desolate places. He was fleeing his brother Esau, who wanted to kill him because Jacob had stolen from him the firstborn's birthright and blessing. And Jacob was heading toward his extended family in search of a wife. And during the journey through the middle of nowhere, this liminal space, the Lord God appeared to Jacob for the first time and reaffirmed the covenant promise. If you've got a Bible, you might flip back to Genesis 28, and we saw this last week. The Lord stood behind Jacob and said, "I am the Lord, the God of Abraham your father and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I will give to you and to your offspring, and your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth. And you shall spread abroad to the west, and to the east, and to the north, and to the south, and all of the families of the earth shall be blessed in you and in your offspring. Know that I am with you, and will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you." And so we, the readers, are now set up with this incredible promise. We need to know what happens next. Jacob needs to get himself a wife. Jacob needs to have some kids. And then he needs to move back home, back to this place, in order to fulfill and receive these promised blessings of God. But as you might expect, it's Jacob. So none of this is going to happen in a straight line. So if you haven't done so, turn to Genesis 29 and allow me to give an overview and a summary of what comes next. So after many days of traveling alone, Jacob comes across a bunch of shepherds who are preparing to water their sheep at a well. One of those watering the sheep is a young woman named Rachel who catches Jacob's eye. She happens to be the daughter of his uncle Laban. After an excited greeting, Rachel runs to get Laban. The storyteller puts it this way in verse 13. When Laban heard the news about his sister's son Jacob, he ran to meet him and embraced him and kissed him, and brought him to his house. Jacob told Laban all these things, and Laban said to him, "Surely you are my bone and my flesh." And he stayed with him a month. Now, as you're going to see, it turns out that Laban has more in common with Jacob than just DNA, just bone and flesh. They both are deceitful and manipulative, even with their own families, in order to get what they want. And Jacob has just told Laban all the family secrets. So after getting a month of free labor from Jacob, Laban finally asks for what Jacob might want as a wage in return. And Jacob comes clean, and he says he wants to marry Rachel. And the storyteller records it this way, verse 16. Now Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah's eyes were weak, but Rachel was beautiful in form and appearance. Jacob loved Rachel, and he said, "I will serve you 7 years for your younger daughter, Rachel." Laban said, "It is better that I give her to you than that I should give her to any other man. Stay with me." So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed to him but a few days because of the love he had for her. Here's a couple things you need to know. The name Leah can mean weary, but it is also similar to the word for cow. The phrase that Leah's eyes were weak is ambiguous. It might mean that they just didn't have much fire and sparkle, but it might imply that she was cross-eyed, or had bulging eyes, or a wandering eye. We're not sure, but the context is clear that her appearance stands in stark contrast to her little sister. Because Rachel's stunning. She's sexy. She's the one who's turning the heads of all the boys in town. And not surprisingly, it's Rachel that Jacob wants as a wife. But Jacob has nothing to offer as a bridal price, which was part of the custom. So Jacob offers to work for Laban for 7 years. Some would say that this is exorbitant. It's way beyond what would have been expected, even in that culture. But Laban, knowing that Jacob can't go home, is more than willing to exploit his nephew. And notice that Laban never actually says yes. Now, what comes next is like an ancient soap opera. Laban hosts a great wedding feast. As is the custom, the bride is veiled and kept separate from the groom. The wine is flowing freely. People are having a great time, if you know what I mean. And finally, Laban brings his daughter, all veiled, to Jacob so they can enter the wedding chamber and consummate the marriage. But Jacob the deceiver has himself been deceived. The storyteller puts it this way in verse 25, "And in the morning, behold, it was Leah. And Jacob said to Laban, 'What is this you have done to me? Did I not serve with you for Rachel? Why then have you deceived me?' Laban said, 'It is not so done in our country to give the younger before the firstborn. Complete the week of this one, and we will give you the other also in return for serving me another 7 years.' Jacob did so and completed her week. Then Laban gave him his daughter Rachel to be his wife." Now I wonder, does Jacob get the irony when Laban tells him that the firstborn has certain rights? Does he get the irony of being deceived in the dark because his own passions override his better judgment? Is this why Jacob doesn't protest too much? See, Laban has not only duped Jacob into marrying both his daughters, including the older one, who is probably going to be a little bit harder to marry off, but he has also gotten 14 years of free labor out of Jacob. Meanwhile, what's the message sent to Leah? She's not wanted, and the only way her father can marry her off is through trickery. And what is Rachel thinking? She probably thought she was being given in marriage to Jacob, who loved her, and now her older sister has usurped her. She knows what's going on in the wedding chamber that night. The man who loves her is having sex with her sister. Now, pause here for just a moment. Let me make two quick comments just about culture, and particularly around the institution that it was polygamy. First, we need to remember that polygamy is not endorsed. In fact, the Bible does not always condemn polygamy, but it certainly does not condone it. In fact, when you read carefully through the scriptures, you'll find that every single time it comes up, it is a vivid illustration of how it always leads to disaster. So first, polygamy is not endorsed. And second, we need to be careful about a chronological snobbery. See, we assume, because of our culture, that marriage should be based upon love and happiness. But that is a particularly modern notion when we start considering the many millennia of human history. It's not that love was absent in previous eras, but marriage would have been entered into more on the basis of commitment and the need for stable and large families to keep the generations going. And so while we might be very well justified in criticizing the polygamy of previous eras, such as that of Jacob, those of that generation might look critically on our serial monogamy through multiple marriages, divorces, and remarriages, our prevalence of extramarital affairs, our single-parent families, our high rates of cohabitation outside of marriage, our low birth rates, our failings to care well for our parents and grandparents. So we just need to be careful, and we need to be wise. Now back to Jacob. To fulfill God's promise, Jacob needs to build a family. Again, the storyteller puts it this way in verse 30. "So Jacob went into Rachel also, and he loved Rachel more than Leah, and served Laban for another 7 years. When the Lord saw that Leah was hated, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren." Now, our storyteller then telescopes time and overlaps some events to give us the birth of Jacob's sons. Let me see if we can just kind of actually give you a visual of Jacob's family tree, if you will. So we'll start out with this image of, here's Jacob, and you see his brother Esau to his left there, and he's got his two wives, Leah and Rachel, to the right, and the family up above them. And so as they start out, Jacob is able, with his wife Leah, to have four sons, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Rachel is unable, as we've heard, to conceive. And so she engages in a practice that, again, is foreign to us, but was not uncommon in that day, to have her maidservant serve as a surrogate mother. And so Rachel gives Jacob her maidservant, Bilhah, to be another wife. And Bilhah has two sons, Dan and Naphtali. Meanwhile, Leah stopped being able to have children of her own. And so she gives her maidservant, Zilpah, to Jacob. And then she has two more sons, Gad and Asher. Leah starts being able to have children once more through a whole kind of quirky little story. And so she has two more boys, Issachar and Zebulun. And finally, after all this time, Rachel has a son named Joseph. Now, for those of you keeping score at home, that's only 11. And some of you are thinking, wait a minute, I thought there were 12 sons. There is a 12th, Benjamin, who will be given to Rachel when they get back to the land of Canaan. But for now, we get the 11. Jacob's got a family, right? This family that was promised to him by the Lord God. So he's starting to get a little bit of an itch. It's time to maybe start turning back home. But Laban knows he's got a good thing going with Jacob working for him. And the Lord has blessed Laban because of Jacob. So when Laban asks what Jacob wants in return for letting him go, Jacob says, hey, you know what? Don't give me anything. Just tell you what, why don't you let me take the speckled and the spotted dark sheep and goats? You know, all those animals that aren't going to be winning any prizes at the county fair. You keep the purebreds, I'll get the mongrels, and that works, right? And Laban agrees. But then still more chicanery follows, because Laban actually takes those sheep and goats that should have gone to Jacob, and he gives them to his own sons, and then sends them away. Realizing that Laban has one more time acted deceitfully, Jacob then takes the remaining flocks. He practices some pretty fancy animal husbandry to build up a strong, if funny-looking flock for himself, while leaving the weaker animals for his uncle. And finally, Genesis 30:43 says, as a result, Jacob became very wealthy with large flocks of sheep and goats, female and male servants, and many camels and donkeys. Jacob is loaded. Now, finally, Jacob is ready with this large family and this great wealth. It's time to go home. Because the sons of Laban are beginning to turn on Jacob, even while his two wives are beginning to turn on their father. Genesis 31:3. Then the Lord said to Jacob, go back to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you. Rather than confront Laban directly about all of his abuse and his injustice, Jacob chooses, what I would argue is a little more immature path of just fleeing and running away from his uncle. Jacob reveals his plan to Rachel and to Leah, sharing that it is God who has blessed him with wealth and who is now calling him to return to their homeland. And Rachel and Leah don't seem to protest, as they now have very little loyalty left towards their father. In fact, the storyteller says in verse 14, then Rachel and Leah replied, do we still have any share in the inheritance of our father's estate? Does he not regard us as foreigners? Not only has he sold us, but he has used up what he paid for us. Surely all the wealth that God took away from our father now belongs to us and our children. So do whatever God has told you. Laban's used up their dowry, and they haven't received a thing. And so the two daughters are beginning to turn on their father. Kind of gets me thinking of a little bit of a Nebula and Gomorrah turning on Thanos here. This is not going to go well. And then this happens. Verse 19. When Laban had gone to shear his sheep, Rachel stole her father's household gods. Moreover, Jacob deceived Laban, the Aramean, by not telling him he was running away, so he fled with all he had. What's going on? Why does Rachel steal Laban's idols? Does she just want a little memento before leaving home? Or is she trying to get even for what Laban did to her on her wedding night? Is this to maybe to make up for a lost dowry? Well, before long, Laban comes after Jacob and his daughters. Laban seems more concerned here, though, about reclaiming his lost gods than he does about blessing his daughters and his grandchildren. After Rachel deceives her father so that Laban's search for the idols comes up empty, Jacob finally unleashes his anger. In response, Laban tries futilely to claim that everything, the daughters, the children, the flocks, they're all his, he says. But he can't make his case, and he relents. Hadn't he given his daughters to Jacob in marriage? And yet here, Laban is trying to intimidate Jacob to get his way by force and by threat. I mean, he's the one who's got an army ready to go. So he tries to put himself in the position of power. But despite Laban's attempts to intimidate Jacob and to force him to stay, Jacob is finally becoming a man on his own, out from under his mother and now out from under his uncle. And as the scene ends, Jacob and Laban make peace with each other. Laban returns home. Jacob is poised to return and take up his place with his own family. So here again, remember what we saw last week. When God had given the promises to Jacob, Jacob made a vow in response. Jacob said, "If God will be with me and will watch over me on this journey I am taking and will give me food to eat and clothes to wear so that I return safely to my father's household, then the Lord will be my God." God is fulfilling God's end of the bargain. God is fulfilling the covenant promises. The question is, will Jacob now fulfill his vow? Will the Lord be Jacob's God? And Leah's? And Rachel's? And ours? So as we listen for what God would say to us through this story, let's remember our interpretive key. The characters here are not models for us to follow, but they are mirrors in which we get to see ourselves more clearly and windows through which we get to see Christ and the gospel. So with this in mind, let's consider Laban and his passionate pursuit of his household gods. You see, Laban is not the only one in our story who has household gods or little gods that are dictating his actions. And I contend that you and I do too. You see, from a biblical perspective, idolatry is having another god other than the true God be the God that you serve and worship, the one you put your faith in to save you. See, here's how this works. First, all human beings are worshipers. Everybody worships. We cannot help it. We just do it. Because humankind was wired for worship at the beginning of creation. But now sin distorts and it diminishes our worship like everything else. The things we give our time and our energy to, the things we give our money to, the things we give our love and our devotion can move from being good things to being ultimate things in our lives. And so we take something that God has created, often a good thing, and we elevate it to be above all else, on par with the Creator God or even more, and we give it our heart. So whatever you hold in highest esteem and you devote your life to is the object of your worship. Whoever or whatever is most important to you that you entrust with your hopes and your fears, that is your functional God or your household God. Your household gods can sometimes be hidden from you until circumstances threaten to take them away. And then we become paralyzed with fear. We burn with anger. We struggle with despair. And like Laban, we desperately give chase to get back what we have worshipped. So first, all human beings are worshipers, but second, all human beings long for salvation. And this, too, gets wrongly directed. We experience pain, we experience loneliness, we experience insecurity or fear or a lack of knowing our place in the world, and we need someone or something to save us from this. Because if we stay where we are, it feels like hell. And so we look to someone or something to rescue us. Anything we look to for salvation other than the Lord God has become our functional God or our household God. And these household gods or idols, again, aren't necessarily bad things. Idolatry is turning a good thing into an ultimate thing. And so idolatry is marked by those two actions. We serve our household God or idol. What was part of creation is now set above creation, and we begin to order our lives around it. But eventually it enslaves us. And then we hope our God or idol will save us. We are looking for some way to prove or to justify ourselves so that we can taste, get this little taste of heaven, or at least get some deliverance or rescue ourselves from what feels like hell. But all gods other than the Lord God eventually disappoint us. See, our household gods steal from us. Now go back to Laban. It's easiest to see that Laban has household gods because his are connected to actual objects, idols which Rachel steals. The Lord, the God of Jacob, speaks and orchestrates events and history and transforms lives. By contrast, the household gods of Laban can do nothing. They're powerless. They need to be protected. But there is a spiritual power at work in Laban's life beyond just the physical idols that Rachel takes. And it's a power that is at work in many people today. Why does Laban lie and deceive and manipulate even his closest family members? See, Laban's passion appears to be possessing. He is not content with the great wealth found in the livestock Jacob has accumulated for him. He is willing to cheat and to steal to get still larger flocks. Up to the very end, he claims that all the animals are his own, fearful and angry at the thought of losing any of them. Even worse, he treats his children and grandchildren, as well as Jacob, as though they were possessions to be used for his own personal gain. Before Rachel stole his idols, Laban's household gods were stealing from him. His greed robbed him of contentment. His selfishness stole the opportunity for joy with his daughters and delight in his grandchildren. His fear of letting go of people and things ultimately robbed him of both. See, Laban's household gods are at work in us today, too, when we worship and seek salvation through possessions and power. We might speak of working for financial security, but what we're really after is the emotional and spiritual security we hope that greater financial resources will bring. For some of us, our household gods might be seeking status or influence or control over our lives. If feeling weak or if feeling powerless feels like hell to you, you're going to be tempted to idolize power, to seek positions and influence that help you feel strong and independent. The lie is that this will give us freedom. But the ego always gets involved, and our pursuit of autonomy forces us to bow down before the idol of our own will. Our possessions begin to possess us. Our gods steal from us. Now consider Leah. Leah suffered terribly as the undesired wife of Jacob. She hoped in vain that by bearing Jacob a son, she would win his love. She continued to bear him children, and with each birth, she prayed that she would move closer to his heart. In fact, each name of Leah's sons reveals her desire for Jacob, a deep desire to be seen and to be heard and to be loved. Back in chapter 29, the storyteller records it this way, saying, "The Leah became pregnant and gave birth to a son. She named him Reuben, for she said, 'The Lord has noticed my misery, and now my husband will love me.' She soon became pregnant again and gave birth to another son. She named him Simeon, for she said, 'The Lord heard that I was unloved and has given me another son.' Then she became pregnant a third time and gave birth to a son. He was named Levi, for she said, 'Surely this time my husband will feel affection for me, since I have given him three sons.'" And it goes on from there. Do you hear the cry of her heart? The household god of Leah is still present today. Whenever we make an ultimate thing out of the good thing of love and of marriage and of family. Now, some of us come from very difficult family situations where we did not feel seen and heard and loved, and we dream of finding the one, that one person, that perfect person who will satisfy those deep, unmet longings. Our culture idolizes romantic love, and regrettably, the Christian church in our culture idolizes families. But these household gods will steal from us too. Now consider Rachel. Rachel was the beautiful one. She's the loved one, but she's also the barren one. No matter how intensely Jacob loved her, she could not conceive a child. And with each child that Leah bore, Rachel, her misery increased. At one point, Rachel sought to blame Jacob for her barrenness and subsequent jealousy. Chapter 30, verse 1, when Rachel saw that she was not bearing Jacob any children, she became jealous of her sister, so she said to Jacob, "Give me children or I'll die." Now remember, your anger and my anger, our anger often reveals our gods that steal from us. Why is she angry? Just as with Leah, the names that Rachel chooses for the boys that she gets through her surrogate are telling. Verse 6, Rachel named him Dan, for she said, "God has vindicated me. He has heard my request and given me a son." Then Bilhah became pregnant again and gave Jacob a second son. Rachel named him Naphtali, for she said, "I have struggled hard with my sister and I'm winning." What's Rachel's household god? Rachel's sense of identity and worth is tied up in comparisons. She was the beautiful one, the one who got all the attention, the one who was always on top, but now she's not. If she's not winning, then who is she? What is she? See, each woman seems to have what the other is deprived of and wants most. As one commentator notes, one is beautiful, the other homely. One is fertile, the other barren. One is the archetypal mother, the other the perennial lover. Each is miserable because she covets what the other possesses. Neither feels whole. Neither can appreciate her unique attributes because each is so focused on the other's perceived advantages. Their sibling rivalry, compounded by having to share a husband, is a striking example of how women can become locked in competitive cycles of self-contempt and competition. They're looking for salvation from their household gods. And finally, let's not forget Jacob. We've repeatedly seen that Jacob is often unable to stand up for himself. He can be passive-aggressive and a people-pleaser. He can be impulsive one moment and then totally non-committal the next. All the while, he's scheming and deceiving as needed. It's not a stretch to say that Jacob's household god is himself. It's his self-interest. It is self-protection. Can the same be said for us? Now, I've argued that these stories are not only a mirror for us to see ourselves, but also a window through which to see Christ and the gospel. So there's one last little thing before we close. Of Jacob's 12 sons, the fourth one is a guy named Judah. Judah's not the firstborn, but Judah will become the one through whom the king will come. See, at the end of Jacob's life, he gathers his sons together. Unlike what his father did, he'll do the blessing right. With all the family around, he will bless his sons. And when he blesses Judah, this is part of what he says. "The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he to whom it belongs shall come, and the obedience of the nation shall be his." Who is Jacob talking about? Yeah, I can hear the whispers. It's Jesus. It's the Messiah. See, later prophets will confirm that, and the New Testament writers will as well. Judah's mother is Leah, which means that Leah will be the mother of Jesus. She who is the weak and the rejected one. Jesus enters our world through weakness and rejection, and he enters into your weakness and rejection and mine to give us his strength and his grace. Jesus is the true God who replaces all of our household gods. We need not worship and rely upon the gods of power and of possessions, of finding the love of another person, or of showing ourselves to be better than other people, of always winning and coming out on top. We don't need to worship the gods of self-protection and of self-interest, because those gods have stolen from you, but Jesus will not. The invitation this morning is to turn from all of those household gods that we have been chasing after like Laban for so long, and to put your trust in the one who comes through Jacob and through Leah and through Judah, the one who is Jesus, the true God, God with us, the only one as the triune God who is worthy of your full worship and devotion, worthy of you giving your life and your heart to, the only one who will truly be your salvation and deliverance from all that feels like hell, and a literal one as well. So this morning, the invitation is here that we would fix our eyes upon him. Will you do that?